Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl, doing my first show after an 8-month hiatus. Today you'll hear some 9/11 updates as we approach the 20th anniversary of that tragic event that altered our world. And governments around the world, under the guise of fighting terrorism, have centralized power, used massive censorship and surveillance, enriched themselves, and murdered millions of people in the global war on terror, and have eroded our civil liberties. Then we'll take a look at the next phase of the global elite's plan for total control, this time under the guise of protecting you from a dangerous virus. So let's begin with the 9/11 updates. The two groups that continue to actively pursue truth and justice for the events of September 11, 2001 are Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth and the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry. The Architects and Engineers website is ae911truth.org. They're involved in several projects. One is a new epic graphic novel written by Andy Steele, who works for Architects and Engineers. It's titled Born on 9/11, and it's soon to be available from their website, which again is ae911truth.org. Another one of their projects involves suing a government agency. A few years back, researchers at the University of Alaska at Fairbanks conducted a study of the collapse of World Trade Center 7, the 47-story building that was not hit by a plane on 9/11/2001, yet collapsed that evening. NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, was charged with investigating the collapse and falsely concluded that it came down by office fires. The University of Alaska study, which lasted several years, on the collapse of World Trade Center 7, proved that it came down by controlled demolition. So the Architects and Engineers requested a correction from NIST, and NIST responded with an unlawful denial of that request. So Architects and Engineers and its fellow requesters will now sue NIST for its flagrant violation of the Data Quality Act. So that's in progress right now. Architects and Engineers has also made a film of the collapse of World Trade Center 7 and the University of Alaska study, and you can get a copy on their website if you're interested. Again, that's ae911truth.org. They're also involved in a petition for a new investigation in the UK of the death of Jeff Campbell, who died at the World Trade Center on September 11th. In the original inquest, the coroner stated that the North Tower collapsed due to the airplane hitting it. The Architects and Engineers have also teamed up with the victims' family members and the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry to take legal action against the FBI, with the aim of forcing the FBI to assess and report the evidence of the World Trade Center's explosive demolitions, as well as other unaddressed 9/11 evidence. In 2015, Congress mandated the FBI have a 9/11 review commission to conduct, quote, an assessment of any evidence now known to the FBI that was not considered by the 9/11 commission related to any factors that contributed in any manner to the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001, unquote. The FBI's report didn't include an assessment of evidence related to the World Trade Center's controlled demolition, nor any of several other areas of evidence known to the FBI. So now, the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry and the Architects and Engineers and victims' family members have teamed up to sue the FBI over this withholding of evidence. Architects and Engineers also has a weekly podcast done by Andy Steele called 9/11 Freefall, which you can also find on their website. So they're very active, going strong. And then I mentioned the second group, the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry, whose website is full of information and evidence and details about their lawsuits. To learn more about all of this, their website is LC4, spelled out, so F-O-R, so LC4, 911.org. Now, have you heard of any of this in the mainstream media? The University of Alaska study on the collapse of World Trade Center 7 is a game changer. It proves controlled demolition. You'd think that would be big news, but it's not in the mainstream media or the halls of Congress. How could 19 Middle Eastern men with box cutters, if you believe the ridiculous official account of 9/11, be able to wire World Trade Center 7 for controlled demolition? The answer is they couldn't. World Trade Center 7 housed the CIA among other government agencies. The biggest lesson I've learned since the events of September 11 happened and our government waged war on innocent people in Iraq, Syria, Libya, Afghanistan, and elsewhere is not to believe anything the government or the mainstream media are saying. So when talk of the coronavirus started and the lockdown started and we were forced to close our businesses, stay at home, wear masks everywhere, I knew to question what we were being told. I'm sure the mainstream media and our governments tell the truth sometimes, but this was not one of them. We've all been inundated now for 18 months with fear-inducing statistics on COVID cases and deaths, and told repeatedly that masks prevent the spread of the virus and that lockdowns also helped, and that there was no treatment or cure, and the only thing that would save us were the vaccines. And now we're being told by celebrities and TV anchors how safe the vaccine is and that we all should get it. And now we're being either bribed or coerced into getting it by schools, universities, and employers. It's get it or get out. After being inundated with all of that and the massive censorship of opposing viewpoints by credible doctors and scientists, you may find it difficult to even consider that you've been duped. But there are thousands of doctors, scientists, virologists, and epidemiologists from around the world who say you have been. And they back it up with evidence. And they're being massively censored. I'm going to share one doctor's views on this in just a minute. But first I want to comment on a response I got from a listener after one of my last shows that aired in November of 2020 on this topic. He said he didn't agree with me and he thought that I was giving out misinformation and that he did believe in a doctor he heard on NPR. So just as a side note, the World Economic Forum, the WHO, and Bill Gates are some of the key players behind the COVID-19 narrative and the push for vaccines. The professor that the listener liked on NPR was Dr. Peter Hotez, a professor at Baylor College of Medicine. He's got great medical credentials, and as a side note, he grew up in West Hartford, but he also gets lots of money from the Gates Foundation. In 2011, when he was president of the Sabin Vaccine Institute, the Gates Foundation donated $12 million to Sabin. In 2007, he received $52 million from the Gates Foundation to conduct and develop clinical trials in Brazil for his hookworm vaccine. I'm sure he's done some really good work in his life, but I think it's fair to question whether receiving millions of dollars from the Gates Foundation on multiple occasions might have some influence on the positions he takes concerning the COVID narrative and vaccines that Bill Gates is pushing. NPR has also received millions of dollars on multiple occasions from the Gates Foundation. They're not alone. The Gates Foundation also gives money to CNN, NBC, ABC, and I'm sure most of the rest of the mainstream media. According to an article in the Seattle Times posted on February 19, 2011, called "Does Gates' Funding of Media Taint Objectivity?" And here's a little quote from that article. The foundation has invested millions in training programs for journalists. It funds research on the most effective ways to craft media messages. Gates-backed think tanks turn out media fact sheets and newspaper opinion pieces. Magazines and scientific journals get Gates money to publish research, and medical experts coached in Gates-funded programs write columns that appear in media outlets from the New York Times to the Huffington Post. While digital portals blur the line between journalism and spin. They also ask the question, how can reporting be unbiased when a major player holds the purse strings? So the point I'm making is that when it comes to COVID-19, you're not getting all the facts. So when it comes to COVID-19 and the drastic measures our government and governments from around the world have foisted on us to allegedly combat the virus are not supported by science and are being challenged by many scientists and doctors from around the world. And now you're going to hear from one of those doctors from an interview that was posted on Brand New Tube on December 31st, 2020. I think it was originally aired in November of 2020 and then posted on YouTube, which then censored it. And some wise person reposted it to brandnewtube.com, where it hasn't been censored to date. The interview was conducted by Jeanette Roche of Bridge City News in British Columbia, Canada. She interviews the courageous Dr. Stephen Malthouse, a family physician from Denman Island, British Columbia, on the issues related to COVID-19. I chose to air this particular interview because I thought it was a good, concise summary of what many, many doctors and scientists from around the world are saying and agreeing with and who are all being censored. So here is Dr. Malthouse's response to the first question about COVID-19 cases.
Well, you have to differentiate COVID cases, which are people that have positive PCR tests. And those could be completely healthy people without any symptoms. And a majority of them are like that. Those would be determined to be cases. Now, normally in medicine, a case is someone who's actually sick. Now, these aren't sick people. And when we look at hospitalizations and death and also ICU admissions, we see that there's been no change in the last year than what we've seen in previous years. So looking at all-cause mortality is the most important measurement. And the reason behind that is because the COVID diagnosis is based on a PCR test. This is where they take a swab from your nose and then they amplify it multiple times. Normally you would amplify that 25, maybe 30 times the maximum. It's a bit like taking a Xerox and then re-Xeroxing the Xerox and re-Xeroxing the Xerox in an attempt to actually identify and match up RNA, which is taken from that swab, with the RNA from coronavirus. Now, if you over-amplify that, which in Canada they're doing 33 to 45 times across the different provinces, then you will actually make everybody positive who's got any little bits of RNA in their nose, and it doesn't indicate that they're actually infective. These people cannot pass it on. So what you're doing is you're finding what we call cases, but these are not really sick people. So if you keep talking about cases on the news, everyone's going to be misled, and that's what's happened. So people are running around frightened of these cases. We call it a case-demic. But in fact, there are very few patients who have COVID at this time. So when we look at what happened in the spring and also what's happening right now, we see that the normal curves, the influx of patients, you know, some to the hospital, of course, but people getting sick, is what we would normally see at these times of the year. There's been no change.
Next, he was asked, what were people dying of before COVID came along?
No, if we look at the coroner reports, for example, over this last year, and we see right now, at least up until December the 7th, where we have reports, is that the number of patients that have died from this is exactly what we've seen in previous years. It's a little bit more this year, but you know, we're seeing as the patient population, as the population ages, we're going to see more people getting sick. But this is what we would typically see this time of year. And there's been lots of epidemiologists looking at this around the world. There's really been no change. Now we will see that ICUs get full up and hospitals get more patients in them, but this is what we would expect. This is not due to COVID. Now, if you look at the COVID diagnosis, this is based on the PCR test, which has been completely undermined. We see that PCR test, as I mentioned earlier, because of the way they're using it, it was never intended to be used as a diagnostic test to start with. But because everything is based on that, it's based on sand, essentially. It's like building your house on sand. And it's very difficult to actually call someone a COVID case based on PCR testing. Clinically, there are some unusual characteristics, and those may help you make a diagnosis, but we never did see a pandemic in the spring, and we're certainly not seeing a second wave now. What we have are the normal fluctuation in admissions to hospitals, sick patients you might see in the outpatient clinic, ICU admissions, and deaths. This is quite normal for this time of year. Yeah, people die of what we call influenza-like illnesses, and that could contain COVID. I'm not saying there wasn't a disease called COVID. I'm just saying that we're not able easily to differentiate that from other things like influenza. So you may have seen that if you look at the records, that influenza seems to have disappeared around the world. Now you have to ask yourself, why is that? There are various possibilities. One is influenza could be being diagnosed as COVID. And as you know, there was incentivization for doctors and hospitals to label things as COVID. So it could be that we're actually mislabeling influenza or mislabeling other types of coughs and colds type symptoms and so forth. I mean, we do have sick people, and there's no doubt about that. We have ICU admissions. We have some unusual characteristics in terms of lung findings and so forth, and deoxygenation for people that were diagnosed with so-called COVID. But, you know, the whole COVID diagnosis has completely been undermined by the fact that the PCR test is not valid. And that was recently, I would say, a ruling was made in the Portuguese court that actually threw out PCR tests as having anything to do with the diagnosis of COVID.
Here he responds to a question about the efficacy of wearing masks.
Well, the evidence for masks is actually that they don't work and they're more harmful than we would suspect. And there are various reasons for that. First of all, we're talking about aerosolized tiny particles. These are 0.1 micrograms in size, microns in size, and so that they actually pass out through the sides and tops and bottoms of the mask. They can actually pass right through the mask in many cases. Because it's aerosolized, it goes out into the air and it can linger in the air for 1 to 3 hours. So there's no way you can contain that by wearing a mask or social distancing. Masks are actually a mistake. The downside of masks are multiple. Physically, they shred, they contain your exhalation, so you're re-inhaling things that are coming out of your own body trying to get rid of them. And so your risk of getting pneumonias and infections, and what dentists are now seeing as mask mouth, are much higher. And there are other things would cause that, you know, they shred, so all sorts of particles come off the mask themselves, which can potentially cause lung disease later in life. But I think one of the major things that we need to look at masks is the psychological effects of masking people. If you're walking around in a community that has masks on, everybody thinks there's something terrifying out there that you should be frightened of, and that is not the case. Secondly, they block facial expression, so people can't relate to each other, taking the humanity out of humans. And for children, it's causing damage to not just their psychology from the point of view of being able to properly socialize, but also their ability to read people's expressions and to learn. So parts of their brains will be affected by that. Additionally, we have also seen that carbon dioxide levels go up and oxygen levels go down with masks. That's pretty clearly shown. OSHA in the United States has demonstrated that multiple times. And we normally would want to fit people for masks and all that stuff and make sure that they are capable of withstanding the low oxygen tensions, the carbon dioxide. No one should be wearing a mask for a long period of time. It's very dangerous to people's health and to their psychology as well. And we're seeing that in communities. You know, if children are frightened and they think also they're going to be killers, and they're going to kill their family members if they go close to them. And this is completely untrue. So we're teaching children to be frightened of going near other humans, afraid to go near other family members, and being isolated. And this is actually a torture technique that's used by the CIA.
And now he responds to a question about social distancing.
Well, social distancing, keeping 6 feet, is just a rule of thumb. If you spit, it'll go about 6 feet and drop to the floor because it's a large moisture collection, right? But with aerosolized spread, it goes much further. They have studies showing that it goes at least 26 feet, and it can linger for 1 to 3 hours in the air. So, you know, you can't stop it by social distancing. Social distancing is just another method like masking to keep people separate. I don't know if you recognize it, but there's an agenda here to divide and conquer. And that's the next layer down. But social distancing is just what's described as a rule of thumb.
Next, he responds to a question about COVID vaccine safety.
These vaccines are not safe. We have the Pfizer vaccine coming out in Canada. And you know that they skipped animal studies for this. And the ones that they did do with animals, with monkeys, for example, the vaccine did not protect them from getting reinfected. So what we know about these vaccines, the Pfizer vaccine particularly, but also Moderna vaccine, is they do not prevent you from getting the infection. And they do not prevent you from passing on the infection. So you'll still be wearing masks and social distancing and all those, I would say, absurd public health policies. But you'll still have to do that because you'll still be contagious. But what they do is they're told that they reduce the symptoms by a small amount. So your nose may not run as much. That's pretty much all you can expect from those vaccines. Now, when they looked at the effectiveness of those vaccines, they said, well, when we started measuring after 2 weeks, after your second shot of the vaccine, people had less symptoms. And it was 95% reduction of minor symptoms. And so it was described as being 95% effective. But if you include all the adverse effects of the shot itself, which were many of them were level 2 and some level 3. We had transverse myelitis. We had some very serious people. We had 4 cases of Bell's palsy. When you add those into the effects that people got when they were later exposed to the natural coronavirus, we see that the number of symptoms that were the collection of the two, the adverse effects from the shot itself, plus the wild coronavirus contagion symptoms, that those far outweighed what you would get if you didn't do anything. So it makes much more sense to get to actually get the wild virus than it does to get the shot, just from the point of view of what it can do. And it's not protecting you or your loved ones from getting infected. So, you know, it's not going to stop any so-called pandemic, which doesn't really exist anyway.
Here he was asked if we have seen any adverse effects from the vaccines.
Yeah, we have. We've seen people with allergic reactions. Now, the thing about coronavirus is they're peculiar. They tried to make coronavirus vaccines after the first SARS in 2003, but they were not able to succeed after, you know, trying for almost 20 years. And the reason for that is because they have a funny thing about coronavirus. It's called paradoxical immune enhancement. So what it means is that when people got the shot initially, they developed quite high antibody levels, and the researchers thought this is great. But when they were exposed to the wild virus, they actually developed this immune overreaction, this bradykinin storm that we've seen with, you know, what we experienced in the early part of the year. And then these people, a lot of them got very sick. And this is what they saw with animals, that many of the animals, almost all of them died in those research studies. Of course, they've skipped animal studies in a lot of these most recent trials for COVID vaccine. When they did a very similar one with what's called respiratory syncytial virus, in children in the 1950s, they tested 35 children, and 80% of them ended up in the hospital when they were exposed to the wild virus after getting the shot, and two of those children died. So they really stopped doing this type of vaccine investigation and production in this particular type of virus. This is a very dangerous experiment that's going on right now, and they're using humans as guinea pigs. That's why we're waiting now to see what happens after you roll it out among Canadians, is Canadians are going to be guinea pigs. And I tell you, I would not take the vaccine myself.
And here he's responding to a question about what he recommends for his patients concerning the COVID vaccine.
Informed consent is very important. So I think patients can make their own decision of whether they want to have this vaccine for COVID-19. I would say there's no benefits for it. It may reduce your symptoms a little bit, but it will not protect you from getting infected. And the chances of having an immune overreaction that is triggered by the vaccine is so very high that it's going to be much more dangerous than it's going to be beneficial. So I would tell my patients that and let them make the decision. I don't think I would actually be giving my patients a vaccine, because the first part of the Hippocratic Oath is to do no harm. So I would, I think, be restricted in giving them something I thought was very, very likely to cause them harm.
And the final question was about why are debates on how to handle COVID-19 being discouraged? Why don't we hear from all voices?
Yes, there are doctors all across Canada and all around the world that are saying the same thing, but nobody is listening to them. We're rolling out an agenda that is not based on science or evidence. And you'd have to ask yourself why that is. Why would public health be trying to push a vaccine, which they almost have to mandate and coerce you into getting if it's that great? It's because it's very dangerous. And if it's an agenda which does not match public health as it should be, there should be a lot of questions coming up people's minds as to what is going on here, because our government, our public health, our institutions, they're all pushing something which scientists and epidemiologists, vaccine researchers, people that have been actually in the field all their lives are saying is not good for the public, and yet it's being pushed. When you have censorship like this, you have to ask yourself, why is it that all the platforms on the internet, all the mainstream media, that they're completely censoring scientists and doctors around the world? And there's a reason for that, because they have an agenda, and the agenda is to push the vaccine. Now, why would they push a vaccine? Well, it could be that it's going to kill a lot of people. It could be intended to do that. The second one would be that we're looking at passports. Now, passports are a way of tagging you and making sure they know where you are and what you've got. So we could make a lot of money on the vaccines. That's one possibility. The other one is for surveillance. And now surveillance will lead us down further paths. In other words, if the vaccine may not be mandated in Canada, well, I'm sure there will be attempts to do that, but it certainly will, people will be coerced. By that, I mean that they will not be able to go on airplanes, they will not be able to travel public transport. Employment may be based on having the vaccine. You may not be able to go into public spaces. All those types of coercion will come out and people will be forced to take it. Now, the other thing is that the attack on Main Street and getting rid of little businesses, small and medium-sized businesses, means that people will be desperate. They'll have to close their stores because of all these artificial lockdowns, which are not doing any good whatsoever, and people being afraid to go out into public and to go to stores. So those stores are going to lose their business and they're going to go out of business. And subsequently, people will be impoverished and they'll be starving. And so they'll do whatever the government says to get a handout, food and a little bit of money. And in that will be have the vaccine and also to be tagged and surveilled. So that's what's coming next.
And again, you were just listening to Dr. Stephen Malthouse, a Canadian doctor. And this was from an interview conducted by Jennifer Roche of Bridge City News from British Columbia, Canada, which was aired sometime in November of 2020. We've now had 8 months of people getting the experimental coronavirus vaccines, and so we have more information about their adverse effects, and there are many. We're also being told by our government officials and the media that there are no other treatments for COVID. But many doctors around the world say that hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin work well. The doctors around the world are shouting about this, but nobody's listening to them, and their information is being censored and suppressed. And they say they're having very successful positive results with hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin. July 24th was World Ivermectin Day, which is an effort to make people aware of this successful treatment for COVID-19. And then we would not need these very dangerous vaccines at all. There's so much information out there that supports what Dr. Malthouse said in the interview you just heard. In the half-hour time slot that I have, I can't possibly share it all with you. But what I can do is give you some websites so that you can do your own research and come to your own conclusion. The stakes are high. Please don't believe what big pharma, government, and the media are telling you about COVID until you've at least researched what the censored doctors and scientists have to say. According to the CDC's own data, there have been 11,940 deaths from the COVID vaccine and 63,102 serious injuries, with a total of 518,000 plus injuries reported to them. And it's estimated that they only get reported to them 10% of what's actually happening out there. So let's begin with some websites. The first one is Robert Kennedy Jr.'s organization, which is doing great work by spreading information, trying to support children, and taking legal action. Their website is childrenshealthdefense.org. So childrenshealthdefense.org. Then there's americasfrontlinedoctors.org, and you can get ivermectin or hydroxychloroquine on that site by seeing one of their doctors. They also have a legal team that can help out if you're being forced to be vaccinated, etc. So check them out, americasfrontlinedoctors.org. Then there's globalresearch.ca. That's a really great website with lots of information. Then there's the website coviddeaths.com. coviddeaths.com. Another great website is thehighwire.com. So thehighwire.com. Then there's the corbettreport.com. So corbettreport.com. Another one is rents.com. And I don't agree with everything they say on their website, but they do have lots of different articles on many different topics. And Rents is spelled R-E-N-S-E. Rents.com, naturalnews.com. And if you like watching videos, you can go to bitchute.com, and that's B-I-T-C-H-U-T-E, bitchute.com, or brandnewtube.com, and you can find uncensored things there. Then we have activistpost.com, so activistpost.com. Then we have thelastamericanvagabond.com. So thelastamericanvagabond.com. And then a really great researcher, Whitney Webb, has the website unlimitedhangout.com. Unlimitedhangout.com. Okay, so I'm just about out of time. Of course, my shows are all archived at radioforall.net, and that's the digit four, so radioforall.net. And look under my name, Cheryl with a C, and the show should pop up. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.